Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 88 of Season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, taking a palette 1, 2, 3, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Alex Marcus, the podcast director of PopBreak.com. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Hey, Rob, how's it going? I have fallen off of the subway car, but I have avoided the third rail, so I'm doing okay.
Did you get fined, or are you sitting in jail for 3 months?
I opted for jail.
Oh, okay.
I decided I wanted to make new friends. So
it's probably safer. Safer than train surfing.
So who knows? Yeah. And they make the transit police seem like such a fun time, so I'm sure that the prison that they have is a blast.
That's true. That's a good point. Okay, so minute 88 begins with the police car speeding off and ends with Green joining Blue on the stairs. So we ended things yesterday with Daniels giving his driver a command to burn rubber, and they quickly make a U-turn, and this minute begins with the tire squealing, atypical movie or TV trope when you're dealing with a chase, but here the chase is just to get back to where you were, that type of thing.
Yes, and a chase, and they're chasing a runaway subway car that's underground.
But they're not. So
that
they're
adds a fun nature
direction.
To it.
That's yeah, they've been chasing it, but now they decided they're not going to chase it. They're going to go back.
Yes.
So yeah, and then at this point, we're back with our four villains who are. Still in the process of making themselves look a little less suspicious. We talked yesterday a little bit about the hats, and it's very funny because mm-hmm. now we can actually see Mr. Brown's hat, and it looks like a kid's ski hat. It just looks very funny. It has like a bullseye on the top, which might work a little later on, maybe in tomorrow's episode. Maybe the bullseye helps. I don't know. We'll have to wait to see about that. And then Mr. Blue goes, okay, guns to Mr. Brown. And then so we see Green and Blue give their guns over to Mr. Brown. And Mr. Gray just ignores him.
Mm-hmm.
He actually doesn't just ignore him. He puts the magazine back in the gun. being very defiant with what he's doing. And
who could have ever seen that coming?
Yeah, and then Mr. Brown puts his hand out, and Gray just ignores him. And then it's really funny what Mr. Brown does with the guns. I've never noticed this before, and I've seen this so many times. Never even thought about what he did with the gun. He just throws them off onto the side. It's like, all right, no one will ever find these. We'll just put them off on the side here.
Yeah. Well, hey, they're all wearing gloves, so there's no fingerprints.
Yeah.
So.
For sure, but. Again, just to throw machine guns, off on the side is a little funny that they're doing. I mean, I understand why they're doing it, but it's just funny that they're doing it this way.
Yes.
Then we hear like the
especially,
gun.
Well, and especially because like so much of what they've shown us so far is that every part of this heist has been so methodically planned out to the letter that it's just like, oh, and then what do we do with the guns? Oh, I don't know. We just like toss them to the side. It'll be fine.
Let's just put them on the side. That's it. Maybe the plan is to come back four times and take each gun separately. I don't know.
Who knows? We didn't get to see it.
Right. I mean, I doubt that they really are planning on coming back to the scene of the crime. But who knows? Maybe it goes back to what we were talking about yesterday. Maybe the guy who's financing this whole thing has people who work, in the tunnels, and that they're going to come to figure out a way of taking these guns and taking them out. I don't know.
It's possible. They also might just be looking at the guns as like a sunk cost to the heist.
Yes.
Like they did their job. We don't need to recover it.
Let's just hope there are some like little kids playing around, down
in the service and entrance of the subway. Yeah.
That's right. Hey, look what I found.
No, that's just for the giant rats. Pizza Rat is going to be getting a nice gift.
That's true. No, but you see, I look at it and I say, being a little familiar with guns, you'd think that they would have taken them apart even more if that's the case.
Mm.
Not just because they're basically leaving them intact.
Yeah.
Which is
There's a real carelessness to that.
yes, there is. And it's something very unexpected from a plan that is so meticulous.
Yes.
You know, they have everything planned out except for what do we do with the guns. That's it.
Which seems like a big question. It seems
Yeah.
like that should have been one of the first things they thought of. It's like, and then what do we do with the guns?
That's right. And then Blue says to Gray, he goes, "Mr. Gray, would you be good enough to give the gun to Mr. Brown, please?" He goes, "No, this ain't going nowhere. This is gonna stay with me." And then Mr. Blue says to him, "Mr. Gray, will you bring that gun back here, please?" Now, I like the fact that they show that he is completely calm during this situation.
Yeah.
You know, he's not flustered by the fact that Gray is not doesn't want to you know doesn't want to listen to him or anything like that. He's like, "Okay, just give me the gun." "No, okay, just give me the gun." You know, you'd think that at some point his fuse is gonna blow. He's gonna go, "Give me the goddamn gun," or something like that, and he doesn't. So it's an interesting you know, it tells us a lot more, or doesn't tell us new things about the character, but it shows the consistency of the character that Mr. Blue has been calm the entire time.
Yes.
You know,
But there is also something.
even when he had to make the decision to kill somebody, he did it calmly.
There is something about Robert Shaw's performance here, though, that I think it suggests a level of frustration in his voice that is very fun. Because you're right, the more normal thing that you would expect is for anger to be there, right? But instead, it's more of just like an annoyance. Like, okay, I knew you were going to be a problem. Can you just please give me the gun? Can you please give me the gun? No, okay. Well, now you're dead. You know, it's like,
Exactly.
fine.
Right. And then
Fine. I'll kill you.
that's right. And then we see the hippie you know, crawling on the ground towards them, you know, in their direction.
Yes.
Which again, it's great that they're showing. I mean, first of all, you see all the dust fly up. You know, he's already dirty and dingy, it doesn't matter, but you know, it shows that this is not a clean area either. You know.
No, New York City subway famously not clean.
That's right. And we're not talking about on
Especially
the subway. We're
between
talking about,
stations.
we're talking exactly between
Yeah.
stations.
They are not scrubbing that down at the end of the
No. And then you know, we're back with the argument between the men here, and you know, Mr. Gray just doesn't want to give in, and then he just turns around and starts walking up the stairs by himself. You know, like he's just ignoring them. And you know, at this point, Mr. Blue is getting very upset about the whole thing. And he just gives him a stare and, you know, asks him again to give the gun back, to give him the gun. And he turns around and goes, "What if something's gone wrong? What if they're waiting for us up there? I want some heavy artillery with me." And he goes, "Mr. Gray, I won't ask you again." And I love the shot because they give us the point of view of Mr. Gray. You know, like the point of view is we're on the stairs from above, looking down at these three men. You know, you see Mr. Green, who's completely clueless. We see Mr. Brown, who's confused, and then we see Mr. Blue, who knows what's going on and is ready to is getting ready to deal with this. You know, and then Blue just turns around and says to him, "Blow it out your ass, Mr. Blue." And he you know, gives him the you know, doesn't really care.
Yeah.
And just and you know, Mr. And then he as he just keeps walking up, and then he gives him the finger. You know, which you know, it tells us what Mr. Gray really thinks here. Now, where do you think the idea of using the middle finger as a gesture came around?
Oh, I
Bet
want to
you didn't
say it has
see
its
that coming.
origins in. I want to say it has its origins in a Shakespeare play or something. Like, isn't it like first developed in like Hamlet or something like that?
It goes back even earlier.
Really? Okay.
So first of all, it's either known as giving someone the finger, giving someone the middle finger, flipping the bird, flipping someone off. It could also be "fuck you, fuck off, go fuck yourself, shove it up your ass, up yours." any of the any and all combinations of the above. And the idea is to you extend your middle finger, and sometimes people have a thumb that's extended at the same time also, and sometimes people partially extend both the ring and the index finger at the same time also. And I will explain the significance of that shortly. It dates back to ancient Greece and was
Oh.
used also in ancient Rome.
Okay.
Because the idea is it represents a phallus,
Sure.
which I guess makes sense from that perspective. And there are pictures, there are artworks from many years ago that have pictures of people giving the finger also. And it was a symbol for sexual intercourse, but it was done in a manner to degrade, intimidate, or threaten the individual who you're showing the gesture towards. The idea of sometimes curling both your index and the ring finger is to make it look like it's like look like testicles.
Very elaborate.
Yeah. Well, the truth is I've never seen anyone in a movie or in real life do that, so
Yeah.
it's just a little strange. Most people will just extend the middle finger and that's it. You do have movies where you'll have them extend another finger at the same time, and I always believe that they do that to make it so that people don't get offended that they're really cursing them out. That it's just the acting way of trying to show the whole thing. There are Roman busts in Scotland that have people with their middle fingers extended in order to ward off the evil eye. I don't really know how that really fits in. Screw you to the evil eye, I guess. I don't know. There is a famous picture from 1886 of a Boston Braves pitcher named Charles Old Hoss Radbourne, who they have a picture of
That's
the
I mean, that's just wait, we can't just let that go. That's a fantastic name for an 1880s baseball player. That's wonderful.
Yes, it is. So they have a picture of the team from 1886, and he is flipping the bird at the
Nice.
exact same time. And that is the oldest known photograph of someone flipping the bird.
That's wonderful. That's great. I'm glad that it can be a part of baseball history.
Yes. Okay,
You
so now I have to
think
look
they're
up
gonna
more
put that up
information
at
about.
Cooperstown, as part of their museum?
Maybe he played 12 seasons.
Nice.
Okay, here he played 12 seasons for Buffalo, Providence, Boston, and Cincinnati. He's a New Yorker, but he was raised in Illinois. Let's see what. Hey, that's interesting. He played for the Providence Grays. There you go, Mr. Gray.
There you go.
What a nice connection there.
That was a
He was a
purposeful
pitcher.
reference.
Yeah, that's right. He was a pitcher. So he in 1884 he won 60 games, setting an MLB single season record that's never been broken or even seriously approached.
That's insane. Out of how many games? It was probably like 65 games.
I have no idea. I don't know how many games they played that year, but you're right.
There was only like six teams. Like, how many games could they have played?
True. He led the National League in ERA and strikeouts, and he won the Triple Crown that year. And the Grays won the league championship, and then they ended up going and winning the World Series. And he pitched every inning of all three games.
So he has no arm left, is what you're telling me.
But maybe that's why his fingers extended.
Yeah, that was the last thing he did
And
with that arm was flip that guy off.
he died at the age of 42, so
Sure. Well,
he was
live
really
fast,
worn
live
down.
hard, you know?
Seriously.
Made the most of it.
Yeah. Ah, he started off as a right fielder and as the change pitcher, and then eventually became the pitcher.
And all of these accomplishments, what he is most known for is happening to have been photographed while flipping someone off. But
That's yeah.
hey, a legacy is a legacy, right?
Yeah. Oh wow, and the team, the Providence Grays, is similar to the team of the in Major League. They had to either win the pennant or they would be forced to close down the team.
Okay.
Wow, that's just really interesting with the whole thing.
That's a great movie.
Yeah.
If you ever do that 1 minute at a time, you can invite me back. I'd love to do it.
I, for some reason, I think someone has done it. I know someone did Bull Durham.
Ah.
Maybe not Major League. But you see, part of the problem is if you start a series, you have to do the entire series. And the only one of those movies that I like is the first one.
Mm.
So it would be a little painstaking to go through the second and third one.
I did watch the second one
even though I
quite
love Scott,
often.
Even though I love Scott Bakula. I'm a big fan of Scott Bakula, but still.
Yeah, the second one used to be on TV a lot when I was in high school. So I've definitely seen at least 45 minutes of that movie, probably 10 times.
Yeah.
There's a third also.
Yes, the third. No, third one's back to the Miners. That's the one with Scott Bakula.
Mm. Well, maybe there'll be a legacy sequel for Major League, and it'll inspire you to cover the whole franchise.
Let's hope not. So after he retired, he actually got injured in a hunting accident and lost an eye.
Okay.
He's actually in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 1939.
For being the first person photographed flipping off someone?
No, probably for the...
For the 60-game season, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And they claim that the idea of a Charlie horse, when you get a leg cramp,
yeah,
is after him. His name is Charles Old Hoss Bradford. Oh. They claim that it comes from him.
Hmm.
Interesting. All right, and the last thing it says here on his Wikipedia page is that he's known for being the first person photographed gesturing the middle finger.
There you go. Many, many accomplishments.
And wait, they give us more information here. In 1886, an image was captured of him flipping off a member of the New York Giants in the team photo.
Wow.
So he was flipping off another team at the same time. Interesting. Okay, so do you know the first time that the middle finger was used in a movie?
I do not.
So it was in a Hitchcock movie, one of Hitchcock's first movie, The Ring, in 1927, where a misunderstanding results in the ring bearer giving the finger to another member of the wedding party.
How scandalous.
Yes. There's also a famous one with Harold Lloyd, where Harold Lloyd, he's in an amusement park in the movie Speedy, and he looks at himself in a, like one of the mirrors that are not like straight mirrors, and he flips himself, he gives himself
like a funhouse mirror. Okay.
Yeah, funhouse mirror, exactly.
Cool. I gotta be honest, I'm very glad this was not the trivia quiz, because I would have performed very poorly.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah, that's what we could say about the middle finger. So yeah, Mr. Gray gives Mr. Blue the middle finger. It sets off Mr. Blue at this point, because he then pulls out a gun and shoots him, but he shoots him through his pocket, which is great also, meaning that what we've just learned is that Mr. Blue is telling everyone to get rid of their guns, but he still has a gun.
Right.
Obviously not as a conspicuous gun as the others had, but still.
But now, isn't Mr. Gray, isn't he about to shoot our guy, Mr. Blue? Isn't that what we're led to believe?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's about to shoot him. So you're saying it's in self-defense. Therefore, it's okay.
No, not necessarily that it's okay, but that it wasn't a reflection of Mr. Blue losing his patience as much as it was him responding to the situation getting heightened.
No, but he has lost his patience with the fact that Mr. Gray is not listening to him. I mean,
sure.
Mr. Gray starts lifting up his gun.
Yeah.
At that point, he's like, "All right, I'm getting rid of you," and great shot, because it's a shot right to the heart.
Yeah. I just don't think that he's lost his cool, though, right? We agree on that. Like, he still hasn't, Mr. Blue hasn't lost his cool quite yet.
No, he hasn't lost his cool. No, not at all. He's like, okay, one last guy.
Yeah.
And Mr. Gray just falls down very, very easily with the whole thing. Then the you know, I love how he tries to grab onto the railing, but you know, isn't able to really hold on.
Yeah.
To lift himself up. And he's Mr. Gray is in complete shock. He did not expect Mr. Blue to actually shoot him. And then Mr. Green goes, oh my. Oh my God. And
now,
then we get
we're
the
not
dying
really,
shot.
We're not really that broken up about this though, right? Because we've seen for this entire film up until now, Mr. Green's been the bad dude of the bunch, right? He's like
No,
sexually assault. Yeah, Mr. Gray, sorry. Mr. Gray has been the bad dude. Like he's sexually assaulting people casually on the subway. He is threatening to shoot people. He's got a hot head. He's escalating things every step of the way. So if anyone has to go, we're glad that it's this guy, because this of all the criminals, this is the bad one.
Right. And this once again shows us the fact that you know, Mr. Gray is not willing to listen to anything Mr. Blue has to tell him. You know, he doesn't see him as his boss, which to me is another clue that there is someone above.
Yeah.
You know, that Mr. Gray could say, oh well, you know, it's you know, Marcellus Wallace is the guy I gotta speak to, not to you. Who are you?
Yeah. He's not responding like Mr. Blue is the one who hired him to do this job.
No. No, not at all. Not at all. And the death shot is pretty interesting because he like sits up and then just dies.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, his body doesn't like fall backwards or anything like that. That easily.
Now, I feel like the way that you've described this sequence, it sounds like it worked well for you. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
That it worked well for me?
Yeah.
Meaning what? That I liked the way that he died?
Well, that you liked that this series of events occurred and how it was executed within the film.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Of course.
I have to say I was a little bit disappointed by it. I think that Taking Pelham 1-2-3 is a very good movie, but not quite a great movie. And I think part of the reason why is for moments like this. Because they're clearly, from the second that this group dynamic is established, forecasting that there's going to be a conflict. Mr. Gray is going to go rogue at some point. He's going to be like, his bad attitude is going to cause conflict within the group that's going to cause him to, you know, clash with Mr. Blue, right? We know that this is coming.
Right.
And I feel like given that, like, they're not trying to hide that, they're building it over time. The ultimate conclusion being just, hey, he doesn't want to give up the gun, and then he's like a little bit rude, and then he just dies. Feels a little, you know, anticlimactic. I feel like I could have had something more in terms of what the ultimate climax was. Like maybe, you know, Mr. Gray is impulsively tries to take a hostage with them, or is like reckless with someone's life in a really significant way, and that's what causes the conflict. Or like maybe something else that's more creative that I haven't thought of is a way to
no,
have
but
the conflict
I think
hit.
I think this conflict needs to happen when it's just the four of them. Meaning, if you were to say, okay, I want to rape this woman, or I want to take her as a hostage, or whatever it is, and then they would have gotten into an argument and would have shot him, it would have changed the entire dynamics of everything because it would have happened in front of all the other hostages. And the whole idea is that they have slipped away from the hostages as peacefully as possible.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's important to maintain in that sense, right? But I feel like the stakes of that argument should be higher. I think there should be like a moral dynamic to it, not just to like, he is acting somewhat unruly around the what was clearly already agreed to ahead of time, which was like, we're going to get rid of the guns. And he was like, well, I don't want to get rid of my gun. It's like, and then that's it. That's the whole conflict. It feels like there should be something bigger to that conflict that lets us understand more than we already know about those two characters, because all this is doing is telling us what we already know, which is that like Mr. Gray is somewhat selfish and somewhat impulsive and prone to violence, and Mr. Blue is really cool and calm and collected, and he's has no tolerance for Mr. Gray's BS, right? And I feel like
okay.
I want the conflict to raise the stakes of that and give us new information that makes us a little bit more invested. And like, there's a lot of different ways that you could probably do that if you were trying to tackle it as like from a storytelling perspective. But I think what they landed on, it just doesn't, it's just not as compelling as it could be for me.
Okay. Again, I can hear what you're saying. I think that what it comes down to is that, here they have this elaborate plan that's been set up, and the idea is that all of the characters should have realized that this is a great plan, and we have to follow through with it, and that's the conflict here. That Mr. Gray is like, okay, we made this great plan, but I don't really care.
I'm
Everything's
just
worked up until now, but I still don't agree with you.
yeah, because I'm just here
You
for
know what I mean?
myself, so I don't really care what your rules are.
Exactly.
But I
It
feel like
doesn't
that.
bother me that this is the way they do it because, again, they couldn't have had a big gunfight between them or anything like that. I also, since you mentioned it right now, I'm trying to think of something else that might have worked, but I can't think of any other way that it would have worked like this. And again, this what happens here is very important as to what's about to happen also, because they're distracted.
Like maybe like here's an alternate pitch. Like if you don't like the hostage thing because you don't want to break up the whole like the way in which they leave, which I agree is an important piece. What if there's a situation where Mr. Green, who is the innocent of the group, right, has sort of a like kind of has a moral like freak out, right? He kind of just starts to panic a little bit over the situation. He's in over his head. This has escalated more than he thought. He didn't know those people were probably going to die in the subway car. Now he realizes that that's what was part of the plan, and he feels uncomfortable with that. And then there's a disagreement between Blue and Gray over what to do with Green, where Blue is just like trying to calm the situation down, and Gray is like, we got to just kill this guy. He's a problem. And like that lets us establish the idea that like Blue is a bad guy, but he has a sort of code and he's a reasonable person. Gray, he's just out for himself. He's prone to violence, to dispatching people without really thinking about the consequence, and just like, this guy is an issue. We got to get rid of him. And it also helps us feel a little bit more invested in Green, in his identity as someone who is part of this group but is not a cold criminal like the rest of them, you know?
Okay, I can see where that would work. But for me, part of the whole thing is that we've seen with Blue the entire time is he has always been protecting Green the entire time. He's been helping Green along with the fact that he's this novice and stuff like that. So if they would have added him trying to really defend Green against Gray, I don't know if that really would have worked. Again, I know I keep going back to Reservoir Dogs, but the same thing with Reservoir Dogs. Mr. White is protecting Orange because he doesn't know that Orange is a cop. And he's willing to give up his own life for that whole thing. And that's the type of scenario that you basically have just played out here. The gray is basically saying, okay, we're now going to go kill Green because we don't trust him. He's an asset, and so okay, someone else did something similar to your idea, but I can see where that could go, but I don't think it would work here as well as it does in Reservoir Dogs, because Reservoir Dogs also gives us the background of some minor background of the characters. But it also shows their connection. Here we have no idea of the connection between Blue and Green, or Gray and all of them, or anything like that. We're kept completely in the dark about all that.
I do think that the ambiguity of that still works in the like alternate pitch that I'm giving you, because
Okay.
you're getting to learn a little bit more about who they are as people and their relationship to each other with that conflict without having to learn about their backstories. And like they could just subtly hint at that those things in a way that brings us into the characters more and then makes the ultimate death of Gray feel a little bit more impactful than just like, oh, the guy who is a jerk, he and never listened, was a jerk and didn't listen, and now he's dead.
Okay. Again,
Small
I can see
critique,
where. Yeah. Okay. And at this point, then Mr. Blue says, "Let's get his money, Mr. Green. Come on." And the two of them start going up the stairs. So it's actually very interesting That's Blue's first reaction. You know, we've killed Gray. Let's split up his share.
Yeah.
But again, I like the way that they do this. It fits well. And then he runs up and starts unbuttoning Mr. Gray's jacket. And Green is a little in shock, but he still comes up to go help him. And as Green is walking up the steps, that's where this minute ends. So, did you have anything else you want to say, Alex, about this particular minute?
No, I think I covered all of it. And again, I'm sounding probably like more critical than I mean to. It's just a difference between like a movie where it sets you up to expect something and then it pays off that expectation versus a movie where it sets you up to expect something and then it does something
And then you,
more,
right.
you know?
Okay, I mean, I think this movie surprises us enough.
That's fair.
And then doesn't need to surprise us with everything.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it could be that part of what you're looking at it from the eyes of 2025 and not
Sure.
necessarily the eyes of 1974, because you know, we've had so many movies that have come out dealing with similar types of things over the last 51 years that maybe you know, maybe that's also affected the way you're thinking of it, that okay, this is, you know, what usually happens in these type of movies. For all we know, this is the first movie that did something like this.
Right. Well, and that's always an issue when you go back and watch an older film where it's like, oh, this is such a
Exactly.
trope. And it's like, well, actually, like, this is what created the trope.
This created the trope. Exactly. All right, so every Wednesday we have a segment called Hijack Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five movies about hijackings. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Yes. Okay. So my number five is a little bit of a stretch, but it's very on brand for me. So I had to do it. I just couldn't resist. My number five is Captain America: The Winter Soldier. Obviously, if you've been listening to our episodes, you know I'm a big Marvel fan, a big MCU fan. Now, the entire film, Captain America: The Winter Soldier, is not a hijacking, but it does feature an opening action set sequence that is a hijacking of a major naval vessel, where we get an incredible action sequence where Captain America like jumps out of a helicopter from like, 1,000 feet in the air, lands no problem, and just like immediately shows off like this is why this version of Captain America is a badass and also like a really interesting moral figure inside of a world that is a lot more gray and confusing than he's used to. And so it immediately, for a sequence that is only like about 10 minutes long, it sets up your character, it sets up the action style of this film, which is a lot more hard hitting and than what we saw in the previous Captain America movie, and it sets up the moral universe all within the context of like a hijacking of a bunch of like mercenaries taking over this naval vessel with some intelligence people on it. So the actual hijacking itself couldn't be more generic, but it's such an incredibly effective use of a hijacking sequence to really establish the world and the tone of a movie. So I had to
Okay,
include it.
cool. No problem.
One that is probably going to show up on a lot of other people's lists, I would imagine, is my number four, and that's Air Force One. It's like iconic hijacking movie, right? Maybe one of the most iconic of all time. Not like the best movie that's ever been made, but it's just such an incredible, Hollywood A-list movie star performance by Harrison Ford. Like, Get Off My Plane is just forever and always going to be iconic. Also, I feel like less spoken about is the fact that we have like a scheming vice president played by Clinton Close in this movie, which is also a really fun part whenever I go back and watch it. But if you haven't watched Air Force One, I mean, come on. It's Harrison Ford, he's the president of the United States, and he's on his plane, and a bunch of terrorists hijack his plane, and then they think he's just going to be like a loser, but he's actually an action hero president, and so he kicks everybody's ass. It's great. It's really fun. My next one is a very different tone, a very different vibe. United 93. This movie came out in 2006. It's a very serious film. Obviously, it's about a real terrible tragedy in American history. It's about the plane that went down in Pennsylvania during September 11th. Paul Greengrass directed this film. It is gripping. It is harrowing. Some people feel like it's like too intimate and like raw, given the fact that, it's a group of people who were incredibly brave patriots who sacrifice their lives to save countless others. It can feel difficult to watch, but it's a really important part of history, and I think it's I there's a lot of times when these movies get made about like ripped from the headlines, this moment, this event has happened, what's going, like, we need to make a movie about it. It can feel exploitative, it can feel kind of very surface level. I think Paul Greengrass manages to really honor the people who are on this plane and honor the experience of it, and it's a beautiful tribute, and I think it's like an essential movie for people to see, especially as we get further away from those events. And now there's like a whole generation of people who grew up after that happened. Like, I'm someone who lived through those events as a child, and in a very impactful way. There's so many people who don't have any living knowledge of it, and I think it's a really important film.
Yeah, so I mean, anyone who's listened to my podcast, two seasons ago, I had Corey Johnson on, and he talked a lot about it. And I mean, he also told me that he doesn't talk much about the movie because it was such a powerful experience for him, even though he believes that it was his, the best movie he's ever been in. So,
Now, another movie about a hijacking that actually happened that was directed by Paul Greengrass is my number two, and that's Captain Phillips. It's Tom Hanks stars. It's about, shipping vessel that gets hijacked by some pirates. Tom Hanks plays the captain, the titular Captain Phillips. Barkhad Abdi got nominated for an Academy Award for his role as the lead pirate, became kind of a low-key, fixture in Hollywood for a decade after that, based off of the strength of his performance. A lot of people know, like, look at me, I'm the captain now, right? Iconic meme, whatever. It's a taut thriller. It's really intense. It's very well executed, and you get, it's like, so caught up in the procedural events of the film that then when the finale hits after Tom Hanks' character, Captain Phillips, has been rescued and he's safe and he finally gets to relax. And I think the person in, like, the medical attendant asks, like, are you okay? And you realize, like, everything that he has just been through over the last how many hours, he has been so focused, so fixated on, like, getting all of his people to safety, making sure that the situation doesn't escalate, doing everything he possibly can to survive through this, mostly for other people, like trying to be very selfless in that experience and throwing himself over and over again into dangerous situations to help de-escalate and to keep his people safe. He's finally safe. It's finally over. And, like, the magnitude of it all hits him, and it's truly, that one scene is, like, probably the best piece of acting I've ever seen Tom Hanks deliver, and he's one of our best actors. So for that alone, he deserved to be on this list. And honestly, he was famously snubbed for an Oscar that year, didn't even get a nomination, and that's like a pet peeve of mine that I'll never let go of, because he deserved it. Again, two very serious movies in a row. My number one, very unserious, but I think the iconic hijacking film, at least if you grew up in the 90s, and that's Speed. Keanu Reeves, Sandra Bullock, Dennis Hopper. Just like, what if someone puts a bomb on a bus, and what happens? That's basically it. Turns Keanu Reeves into a movie star all over again, makes Sandra Bullock a star. A wonderful villain performance by Dennis Hopper. He's got lots of them. It's just such a fun time at the movies, and it's just perfect. And the chemistry between Keanu and Sandra is wonderful. The chemistry between him and Dennis Hopper is so great. And it's just, like, it's an iconic piece of movie making. And then we got, like, I don't know, like a dozen more movies that were just like, what if Speed, but in a slightly different situation, right? That just
Exactly.
became a whole genre of movies for a while because it was just so perfect. It just worked so well. So
Oh,
that's my
Speed
number one.
is a diehard. Is a diehard movie also.
It is what if Die Hard but on a bus, and that's fair. But I don't think we can count the Die Hard as a hijacking movie, right? Because they didn't hijack. You can't really hijack a building. So this is bringing the Die Hard model into the hijacking subgenre, and I feel like that is a perfect evolution of the form.
Right. Okay. Excellent. All right. And now we will do the daily game of Name That Remake. We'll spin the wheel. We'll see what we get. Let's see if it's a movie that Alex has seen or not.
Yes, or have heard of.
Okay. How am I going to explain this one I won't give it away in a second.
Uh-oh.
No, it's an easy one. That's the thing.
Ah.
Okay, a small group of people living in rural Pennsylvania try to find a way to keep themselves safe as the area has become overrun by all of these strange creatures.
War of the Worlds?
I didn't tell you what years. Sorry. The movie came out in 1968, and the remake was in 1990.
Oh. They're strange creatures.
Yeah, if I use the real word for it, it'll completely give it away. I can't use the real word. There is a real word for it.
Okay. It's not a Leprechaun movie, is it? I don't know. I need another hint. Rural Pennsylvania, strange creatures, 68 and 1990. I've gotten nothing.
Okay, the 1968 version was directed by George Romero.
Oh, Dawn of the Dead?
Sort of. Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead. See, if I would have just used the word
If you had
zombies,
said zombies,
then
yeah, that's tough. Yeah,
yeah.
because zombies would have given it away. Yeah.
So I had to try and think of a way of explaining that without explaining it. All right. So, Alex, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow all the work that I do for The Pop Break by going to thepopbreak.com, clicking on the podcast tab. You'll see all the podcasts that I supervise and all the shows that I appear on, including Bill versus the MCU, which is a monthly podcast all about Marvel movies and the world around them, including the Netflix shows, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV seasons that we've covered. We've done all of the full f first five phases of the MCU now are in the books for us. We got the X-Men movies we've covered, and right now we're covering our Marvel Entertainment adventure, where we are reviewing a bunch of the recent animated shows that have been released through Marvel Animation over the last few years, including MODOK and Hitmonkey and Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, and the two most recent additions, Eyes of Wakanda and Marvel Zombies, speaking of zombies. So you can check out what we think about all that stuff by going over there. You can listen to that show by subscribing to The Pop Break on all major podcasting platforms. You can also subscribe to It's Complicated, a Tom Holland podcast, where you can hear me and my co-host Manish Mathur talking all about the filmography of Tom Holland. We are covering his films in chronological order. We started with The Impossible, his very first screen appearance, and we're going all the way until 2026 when he has his big month in July when he releases both Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey and Spider-Man: Brand New Day. So in between, we're covering all of his movies, all of his TV shows, all of his stage performances, even some viral videos. It's going to be a blast, and I hope you check that out.
All right, excellent. Sounds great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, chew!
Gesundheit.